The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service and the Associated Press. First of all, an article that was published by the Religion News Service on July 13, written by Yonat Shimron, and entitled, Rebecca Todd Peters is on a mission to get churches to talk about abortion. Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The Reverend Rebecca Todd Peters' neon pink stole bearing the Planned Parenthood logo announced her subject even before she ascended to the lectern. When she started preaching, she got right to the point. Abortion makes many people profoundly uncomfortable, she told a crowd of 200 at the Community Church of Chapel Hill, a Unitarian Universalist congregation. At dinner parties, in polite conversation with friends and family, and, too often, in church. Her sermon, like countless others she has given recently, aimed to challenge the perception that people of faith are against abortion and to tell the stories of women who have had them. An ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church USA and a professor of religious studies at Elon University, where she heads the Abortion and Religion Project, Peters is best known as one of the country's leading ethicists on abortion rights. Since the U.S. Supreme Court announced in May 2021 that it would hear Dobbs v. Jackson, the case that would eventually overturn Roe v. Wade, Peters has given more than 55 sermons and lectures on abortion across the country. Lately, she's been especially in demand in North Carolina, after a new law banning most abortions after 12 weeks of pregnancy and restricting abortion-related medications went into effect earlier in July. Until last year, abortions were legal in North Carolina until fetal viability, generally between 24 and 28 weeks of pregnancy. Last August, a judge ruled that abortion was no longer legal after 20 weeks. The new 12-week ban, which passed with lightning speed by North Carolina's Republican-dominated legislature, stunned many state residents and especially members of the religious left. Although several Protestant denominations, including Lutheran, Presbyterian, Methodist, and Unitarian Universalist, have critical positions in support of reproductive rights, Peters said these groups too often duck conversations about abortion, leaving Catholics and evangelical Christians to win the day with messages that abortion is a sin. Her mission is to step into that void. As a first step, she talks about her own reproductive history, gladly volunteering that at 55, she is married, has two children, and has undergone two abortions. I felt God's presence with me as I made the decision to end two pregnancies, and I felt no guilt, no shame, no sin, she told the congregation in Chapel Hill. A forced pregnancy or birth is not holy. Peters, whose father was a pastor, has been working in the church and on reproductive issues since her first job after college. Working in the Women's Advocacy Program of the Presbyterian Church's Louisville, Kentucky headquarters, she began volunteering to escort women to an abortion clinic. Amid crowds of hostile protesters, shouting, yelling, and intimidating the women. These people said they were Christian, and it was just this huge disconnect for me, this cognitive dissonance, she said. How can these people say they are loving Christians and be so horrible? It set her on a path to study the role of Christianity in shaping cultural attitudes on abortion. She earned a Master's of Divinity and later a Ph.D. in Christian Ethics at Union Theological Seminary in New York. Her mentor there, Beverly Wildung Harrison, wrote the 1983 classic, Our Right to Choose. Peters wants to push back against a moral framework around abortion that requires women to justify their reasons for ending a pregnancy. In this, she's referring not only to the typical justifications, rape, incest, or the life of the mother, but any justification. The underlying assumption is that abortion is wrong and that women have an obligation to bear a child, an idea Peters believes is rooted in Christianity's patriarchal vision of womanhood. This framework leads women to feel ashamed about abortion, effectively silencing them. The pregnant woman is erased, replaced with ultrasound photos of the fetus. Peters instead advocates for reproductive justice, a term that originated among Black community leaders who felt the focus on abortion rights was too narrow and needed to be expanded to include concerns about reproductive health care more generally. Not all listeners at the Community Church of Chapel Hill accepted Peters' arguments. One church member who declined to give her name said Peters neglected to mention one of the Ten Commandments, "Thou shalt not kill." But far more people gave Peters an enthusiastic thumbs up. Outside the community church sanctuary, a long line of people stood to greet Peters. Among them, four women who are reading her 2018 book, Trust Women, as part of their Presbyterian church's reading group. The group invited Peters to speak at their church. One of the women asked her to sign her copy. "I just think she hit it head on. She nailed it," said Roseanne Tiller, a 37-year-old physician and a mother of two who was expecting her third. Tiller said her favorite message from Peters is the three-pronged statement of the reproductive justice movement. Women have the right not to have a child, the right to have a child, and the right to raise a child in a safe and healthy environment. Polls, such as a recent PRRI survey, show majorities of American religious groups support legal abortion. White evangelicals, Jehovah's Witnesses, Latter-day Saints, and Hispanic Protestants are the only exceptions. Even among those groups, support for legal access has been growing. Religious congregations in North Carolina have begun stepping up their support for legal abortion. In the state's Triangle region, an interfaith coalition on reproductive justice formed this past spring, with members of Presbyterian, Baptist, Quaker, Unitarian Universalist, and Jewish organizations. In August, the group will screen a new documentary called Plan C, about activists and providers who are building a network to mail abortion pills to women who need it. One of the churches in the coalition is also planning a two-day symposium this November on reproductive issues. Beth Welton, one of the coalition's organizers, called the day in June 2022, when the Dobbs decision was handed down, "one of the most horrifying days I'd experienced as an adult. We were just complacent," said Welton. "We got out-talked. That's why it's so terribly important as a coalition that we continue to grow and have a narrative to counter that other narrative that people of faith are opposed to abortion." Other North Carolina churches have joined SACRED, the Spiritual Alliance of Communities for Reproductive Dignity, which Peters co-founded with partners in Texas, with the aim of shifting the cultural paradigm around abortion. The group's first in-person training took place in Chapel Hill in April. Peters helped write SACRED's 7-week curriculum that provides religious congregations with guides for small group discussions about sex, reproduction, and abortion. Peters is not waiting for churches to subscribe to the curriculum. She is delivering sermons as far from home as Wisconsin, with pithy statements designed to startle her mainline audiences into action. As she told the Community Church of Chapel Hill, "Abortion is a moral good. Abortion is an act of love. Abortion is an act of grace. And finally, abortion is a blessing." Next, an article from the Religion News Service, published on the 14th of July, written by Catherine Post, and entitled "Brigadoon for Jewish Singers Choral Festival Showcases the Wonder of Music." Tarrytown, New York. 22-year-old soprano Shari Chamovitz flew in on a 10-hour flight from Israel, landing at Newark Airport at 3:30 a.m. July 9 for the annual North American Jewish Choral Festival, held this year in Tarrytown, New York. She didn't get much sleep, but she said the hassle was worth it. "It's been life-changing for me," said Chamovitz, who attended the first time last year. "It was an amazing experience, singing with such a range of people of all ages, beliefs, outlooks on life, and outlooks on Judaism. But it was mostly the musical part of it and the conducting workshops that gave me so much." The festival is jokingly described by several attendees as Brigadoon for Jewish choral singers, a reference to the 1947 musical about a magical town where time essentially stands still. "Every summer we get back and it's like there was never a year in between," said longtime attendee Steve Cohen from Larchmont, New York. For five packed days from July 9 to the 13th, singers attended a slew of workshops on music and Judaism, rallied together for informal community sings, attended nightly professional-level concerts, and formed instant choirs on site, organized by sight reading skill. Hallways of the Sleepy Hollow Hotel, where the festival took place in Tarrytown, were abuzz with conversations and choral music, floating in from the nearest rehearsal room. The festival is unique, not only because of the sheer number of Jewish singers all in one place — there were roughly 400 throughout the week — but because it brings Jewish people together, as well as some non-Jewish ones, of all ages, abilities, religious beliefs, and political affiliations. It's a place where everyone is forgetting about things that tear us apart or divide us, because everyone's singing great music together, said Matthew Lazar, founder of the festival. Lazar, affectionately called Matty by festival goers, was raised in a modern Orthodox family in Brooklyn, where he grew up playing piano from age four, watching the Brooklyn Dodgers, and learning the music of Jewish composers. In 1990, he founded the Zamir Choral Foundation, an organization dedicated to expanding Jewish choral activity. Nobel laureate and Holocaust survivor Eli Wiesel, who conducted a choir in France after World War II, was a long-time president of the foundation. Lazar also founded the North American Jewish Choral Festival in 1990, an immersive event he envisioned as a venue for gathering hundreds of Jewish choral singers and conductors from across different cities. Over two decades later, Lazar, who planned this year's event alongside contributing coordinating committee members Rabbi Daniel Freelander and Jewish music scholar Marcia Brian Edelman, remains a driving force of the festival. He directs the top-level instant choir, and a Wednesday night concert he conducted the Zamir Chorale and the Zamir Noted Choirs, both of which are part of the Zamir Choral Foundation. Audience members swayed, wept, hummed along, and responded to the program, sung almost entirely in Hebrew, with multiple standing ovations. He's the godfather of Jewish music, professional baritone and attendee Edward Pleasant told RNS. Chamovitz pointed to Lazar as the catalyst for her emerging conducting career. Lazar and his wife Vivian invited Chamovitz to be a conducting fellow at last year's festival, setting her up with specialized training and one-on-one coaching. At the Lazar's encouragement, after the 2022 festival, she took on the role of conductor for the Ashkelon chapter of Hazamir, the international teen choir affiliated with the Zamir Foundation in Ashkelon, Israel. In 1 year, Chamovitz grew the chapter from 1 to 10 participants. She hopes to conduct full-time one day. Sadie Grossman, 18, from Long Island, is also in her second year at the festival. She relishes the camaraderie among attendees. "I really just love how intergenerational this is," Grossman told RNS. I feel like even outside of the rehearsal spaces, at lunch, when we're sitting around a table or at the workshops, I'm really asked to reflect on myself as a young Jewish adult. She added that there's a shared humor among the group. You don't have to explain what you mean when you say this mashugana. You don't have to explain the Yiddish words. The entire festival is designed with Jewish participants in mind. From the kosher-only food options, Wednesday evening's meal was a Mediterranean-inspired affair, to the daily prayer services in Reform, Orthodox, and Conservative traditions. Lazar noted the festival is strategically scheduled during the week to avoid Shabbat. These are concerts or workshops or rehearsals, and even though some of these pieces might be in a service, these aren't services, except to the extent that music is a heile Kunst, he told RNS, a holy art. Most of these people, I would have to say, are not in it for the religious experience, but for a spiritual experience. When people want to make music together, there's a quest that's metaphysical. Lazar's observation rings true for Grossman, who sees singing Jewish choral music as a spiritual event anchored in generational memory. It really has this way of grounding and recentering you, even if you're not religious, even if you don't go to shul, even if you don't keep kosher. You can just listen to the music and be immediately taken by how beautiful and thoughtful and warming it is, she observed. Though most attendees are Jewish, there are exceptions. Pleasant, a music minister at Stamford Church of Christ in Stamford, Connecticut, and conductor of Halal Bashir, Praise and Song, choir from Temple Israel of Northern Westchester in Croton-on-Hudson, New York, is a Christian and professional baritone who attended the festival for the first time in 2018. Though he said as a Christian and black person he was initially nervous to attend, his Halal Bashir choir has been invited to perform at several festivals since. Pleasant has enjoyed the breadth of Jewish music at the festival, from classical genres to bluegrass, as well as the chance to network with composers and other conductors. I've met people whose music I've sung for years, and it's just amazing just to get a name on a page and then have that person sitting across from you, said Pleasant. One such composer is Gerald Cohen, also a cantor at the Sharei Tiva at Scarsdale, New York, who attended Lazar's instant rehearsal, ensemble rehearsal of his song Lo Acha Hamlaka Ligmor on Wednesday afternoon. The song, which repeats in Hebrew and English a well-known Jewish phrase from the Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers, you are not required to finish the work, nor are you free to abandon it, was commissioned in honor of healthcare workers, clergy, and other first responders during the COVID-19 pandemic. This is what composers live for, to have people who care about making music in a very passionate way, to take that on and do a beautiful job of it, Cohen told RNS following the July 12th rehearsal. As choirs begin to return to full strength after years of disjointed Zoom singing, masked choirs, and socially distanced ensembles, many vocalists are more grateful than ever for the gift of choral singing. And that gratitude is almost palpable at the North American Jewish Choral Festival. Judaism is not just what goes on in your temple. There's a whole spectrum of other things out there. And it's fascinating to see, said Steve Cohen, no relation to Gerald Cohen. We get people of all sorts. We get very Orthodox people, people from the conservative world, people from the Reform world, people who aren't religious at all but love music. All these different people, there's one thing we can agree on, the wonder and power of choral music. Our last article is an excerpt from one published by the Associated Press on July 20, written by Giovanna Del Orto. Flooded with sightseers, Europe's iconic churches struggle to accommodate both worship and tourism. Barcelona, Spain. A recent Sunday evening mass at Sagrada Familia Parish had all the hallmarks of a neighborhood worship service, from prayers for ill and deceased members to name day wishes for two congregants in the pews. But it also featured security checks to get in and curious tourists peering down to take photos of the worshipers from above. The regular mass is held in the crypt of modernist architect Antoni Gaudi's masterpiece church, one of Europe's most visited monuments. With tourism reaching or surpassing pre-pandemic records in Barcelona and across southern Europe, iconic sacred sites are struggling to accommodate the faithful who come to pray and the millions of visitors who often pay to view the art and architecture. We're working to get ahead of this so that we don't get to a collapse, said the Reverend Josep Maria Turrell, rector at Sagrada Familia and the Barcelona Archdiocese Director for Tourism, Pilgrimage, and Sanctuaries. An increasingly popular strategy is to have visitors and the faithful go separate ways, with services held in discrete places, visits barred at worship time, or altogether different entry queues. This spring, the Vatican opened a separate pathway, starting out St. Peter's Basilica, for those who want to enter to pray or attend Mass, so that they wouldn't be discouraged by sometimes hour-long lines for the average of 55,000 daily visitors, said Basilica spokesperson Roberta Leone. But the challenge remains, how to balance the church's competing roles amid the tourism surge without sacrificing their spiritual purpose. It's just really hard because you also want people to experience your faith, said Daniel Olson, a Brigham Young University professor who researches religious tourism. With an estimated 330 million people visiting religious sites yearly around the world, it's one of the tourism market's largest segments. Worshippers, who often come because celebrated churches tend to have more services than regular parishes, need free access even as tourists often pay fees that are crucial to maintaining the sites. The temple needs to be a place for services and not a theme park, said Jean Albaja after Mass in the Sagrada Familia crypt, which he's attended regularly for six decades. He praised the move in recent years to celebrate one multilingual Sunday Mass at the main altar in the soaring, colorful basilica. There's such demand for the 80 free tickets, however, that several hundred people queuing routinely don't get in, Turrell said. Lay and religious leaders say the histories of the sacred sites should be presented to visitors who are increasingly unfamiliar with faith traditions in rapidly secularizing countries where lesser-known churches are emptying out or being repurposed. Some people go to the cathedral, and they don't realize they're in a church. It's a situation that's developing in nations that were majority Christian, and now faith is cooling off, said José Fernández Lago, rector of the Cathedral of Santiago de Compostela. Filled with masterpieces from Romanesque sculpture to lavish Baroque decorations, Santiago's cathedral attracts hundreds of thousands of tourists and pilgrims who since the Middle Ages have traveled along the Camino routes to venerate St. James's tomb. To preserve its role as a revered pilgrim's church, Lago said, the cathedral doesn't charge entry fees, cap visitor numbers, or require a dress code. On a hot early summer day, a steady stream of pilgrims ducked each other's selfie sticks in front of the jewel-encrusted St. James statue, some still in tight cycling shorts or sweat-stained hiking shirts. But visits aren't allowed during the four daily masses celebrated at the main altar, and priests as well as security guards constantly ask visitors to lower their voices to allow others to pray. It keeps getting harder, said Juan Sexto, who in 10 years working security at the cathedral has noticed a change in how many visitors behave. As crowds surged before the always packed noon pilgrims mass, he kept stepping to the main microphone asking for silence, which lasted a minute or so before enthusiastic visitors resumed chatting. Sexto had a supporter in the second pew. Waiting for mass to start, pilgrim Miguel Angel Arino said the church did well to allow only the faithful during worship times, while leaving the cathedral open long hours for cultural visits. As people, we need the transcendent. Leisure and rest in time with God are not incompatible, Arino said. Without some strategy, however, they can become so. Coexistence between worshipers and tourists has been controversial at Istanbul's Hagia Sophia. Built as a landmark cathedral in the Byzantine era, turned into a mosque by the conquering Ottoman Empire in the 1400s, and open as a museum for the last century, it was converted back into a functioning mosque in 2020 by Turkey's Islamic-oriented government. Now visitors can tour the structure for free outside of prayer hours. In Hagia Sophia's main section where prayers are held, the vast mosaics depicting Christian figures are hidden behind drapes, and most of the marble floor is covered with carpeting. We would like it to be a museum again, said Ricardo Bravo, a tourist from Mexico, visiting the monument with his family. We would like to see more things to understand more, to appreciate more Turkish culture. At many of Spain's most visited churches, the balance was often off-kilter in the opposite direction. So many visitors thronged the vast Basilica del Pilar in Zaragoza on a mid-June Saturday that it was nearly impossible to hear the midday mass celebrated in the small chapel where a statue of Our Lady of the Pillar is venerated. With some 2.5 million annual visitors, Barcelona Cathedral was also close to a breaking point before its council revolutionized the worship versus tours balance over the last few years. It was like being in a market, recalled Anna Villanova, who directs the cathedral's tourism strategy. We had to put some order. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.